Water is the foundation of life. It's so common and so plentiful on Earth that from space the planet appears blue. But less than 1% of the Earth's water is fit for drinking, and many nations are already in crisis. Water, H2O, equals life is the title of a new exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History, and it brings Dr. Eleanor Sterling, who is the director of the Center for Biodiversity and Conservation, to our show. Welcome.
Thank you.
The museum sponsored a survey to find out about people's attitudes towards water before the exhibition. What did you learn?
Well, we learned that there were many things that people didn't know about water that are very important facts, just as the one you just said, less than 1% of the Earth's water is drinkable. Fewer than 4% of the people that we surveyed knew that. We also had people...
I mean, they didn't realize that there's a lot of salt water and very little fresh water?
I think they just hadn't thought about it. It waters around us. It surrounds us in our lives, and yet I think we take it for granted. We forget about... We forget about the fact that salt water is different from fresh water, and only one is really useful for us for drinking at this point.
Somewhere in the exhibition is a statistic that the United States and Canada have the most profligate water use habits on Earth.
Well, we share that with several other countries, but certainly the U.S. and Canada have high water use. And in the exhibit, we have a statistic that shows that in Ethiopia, people drink about use for their municipal and domestic use about 3 gallons a day. And in the United States, it's 150. But we also say...
Well, is 3 gallons too little and 150 is too much?
3 gallons is far too little and too little, and 150 is far too much. In Europe, the statistic we used was the United Kingdom. They use 30 gallons a day in comparison with 150. And I always say, I come home from Europe and I don't think, oh my goodness, thank goodness I'm back somewhere where I feel like I'm in touch with water and I can take showers. There are different ethics and ways that we use water.
What is it? I can't imagine what they do that we don't do, or vice versa. We just leave the water running when we brush our teeth? Does that use up 100 extra gallons?
We use water in a lot of different ways. A lot of our water that is used in the United States goes to outside water use, to our swimming pools, our landscaping. We use 7 billion gallons of water a day for landscaping in the United States. And so we do run our dishwashers and our washing machines oftentimes when they're not quite full. We do use more water in general.
In putting together an exhibit like this, you had to be aware of the fact that you had a wide range of potential audience, kids and adults, and that must present some difficulties because you don't want to bore the people who will know certain things. At the same time, you don't want to exclude the others.
That's true. And in this exhibit, there's something for everybody. We really thought through what to do for the people who want to read every single caption and learn something in every single place, and the people who want to skip through and sort of see the highlights and still take away important messages and information that they've learned. We also have a lot of fun in the exhibit. The exhibit is gorgeous. The exhibit department did a spectacular job bringing water to life.
Including the entrance.
The entrance is a favorite. The entrance is what we call a fog screen. It essentially shows a picture of a waterfall with words from different languages around the world for water. And you're surrounded by water. You see it and you hear water sounds in the background. And you have to walk through that fog screen to make it into the exhibit. And in some ways it empties your mind of what you thought about water before and helps us to reconnect people with water.
So are people hesitant in some cases, afraid they're going to get wet?
I think actually I've seen both adults and children stand there for a minute just saying, I wonder how I get into this exhibit because they have this waterfall flowing and I don't know how to get around it. But they then see other people walk through and it becomes a real hit having people walking through and coming back and walking through again.
One of the things the exhibit focuses on is the water cycle. Can you tell us about that?
Well, sure. Of course, the water cycle we learn about in school, and water is found in lots of different phases on Earth, and it cycles through our lakes and rivers and streams and the ocean to the atmosphere to our deserts and glaciers. And one of the main messages we have in the exhibit is connecting people back into that water cycle and talking about how in the world's water cycle, we're all downstream from somebody else. The water we could be drinking, the water I have in front of me could have come from the Arctic 10 years ago. All the water on Earth is finite. We have all the water that will ever be, and we can't make any more water. And so that's one of the things we say. We talk about water as being a renewable resource, and that's true on a local scale. But on a global scale, water is continually cycling through this water cycle.
Is there loss in the process?
There's loss at the local scale, and in other words, if you take water out from the ground and you water your lawn or you water a crop, then that water escapes to the atmosphere and then goes into the ocean. And so you're changing in a lot of ways where water is found on Earth.
The exhibit says that the average life of a cloud is just 1 hour. I can't imagine. I've sometimes just lolled on the grass and watched a cloud for over an hour.
Yeah, it's essentially, that's an average. So, of course, over time and through space, there's a lot of changes in the clouds. And we basically try to give a lot of fun statistics like that to help you rethink about water, think about water in a different way.
Last Saturday, there was an article in the New York Times that said Atlanta is on the verge of a drought. How vital is it for us to get serious about water when that sort of thing is happening? In fact, the whole South is faced with a serious drought, isn't it?
Yes, we have trouble in the Southwest and the Southeast of the United States in water. And there is, in fact, of the 50 states, 35 water managers in 35 of those states predict that there'll be a water crisis in their states in the next 20 years. So we all need to be thinking about water, and it's a very important issue. I think if you had talked to people in Georgia 5 years ago and said you'll be facing a crisis, they would have laughed at you.
But we have seen right here in New York, we've seen crises of that sort. The reservoirs were down, and suddenly we were told we couldn't water our lawns and do other things which would waste water. And then a rainy summer, and the next thing you know, the reservoirs are back to normal or even full. So isn't there just a normal cycle involved?
There is a normal cycle, but what we're finding with global climate change is that we are predicting the possibility of those cycles changing drastically. So what we know of as a normal cycle may change, and we may have substantially less water in some parts, some times of the year, and substantially more in others. And it's managing ourselves so that we don't get caught out with the situation that Georgia is facing now in the future.
My guest is Dr. Eleanor Sterling, director of the Center for Biodiversity and Conservation. We're talking about a new exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History called Water, H2O Equals Life. Plants have to adjust to water or lack of water. Are we seeing changes right now?
We are seeing changes in agricultural systems, particularly in very dry areas like in southern Africa. We're seeing changes in the Arctic systems as as plants that formerly grew further south start to move north.
And then that also works for within the sea. The natural food of some fish, for example, like krill, have moved to different kinds of waters as the waters have changed, the temperature of the waters have changed.
Right. There's many changes that we're seeing in the oceans as we see both an increase in acidification as well as the temperatures of waters, and that's changing some systems, such as the coral reef systems, that are quite fragile systems that depend on a certain water temperature.
How do freshwater fish process water compared to saltwater fish?
Well, everything that lives in water has this task of worrying about how much water is outside their body versus how much water is inside their body. And freshwater fish spend a huge amount of time trying to keep water out. You don't think about that, but of course they need to be really processing water through their system to be able to survive but also keep water out. And then you have a slightly different problem through osmoregulation with the amount of salt that's in the outside of the body, and salt trying to cross that barrier into the water trying to cross that barrier into the fish is each fish has a special adaptation for the kind of environment that's around it. And different, for instance, albatrosses live in salty waters as well. And they fly long distances over these salt waters and don't have access to fresh water. And so they have special glands within their body that remove the salt from the water and then release that through an area that actually comes out just below their beak, so it looks like they cry salty tears.
So if you don't have a method for processing salt water, you can die. That's why we hear about humans who have drunk salt water and gone mad and died?
That's correct. Many species around the world have adaptations to differing kinds of water, lots of fresh water, lots of salt water. But humans, on the other hand, are not that adaptable. Without somewhere between 5 and 7, if we go for 5 to 7 days without water, that fresh water, we would die. So salt water is not something we have to basically drink a huge amount of water to get rid of the salt to be able to process it in our body.
One of my favorite creatures on the tour at the museum was the mud skipper. It's a fish out of water.
It is a fish out of water. It's a really fun animal to watch. I love watching the kids stand around and look at this animal because it's just unique looking. It is this long, thin animal that it basically is a fish, but it spends a lot of its time out of water and is able to adapt to both air conditions as well as the water conditions to be able to survive.
It looks like the model for the cartoon that people show of fish evolving into humans.
That's definitely true.
We see from the exhibit all kinds of plants and animal have adapted to various water conditions. What about humans? Will we evolve into a different species given the changing availability of water, do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think one of the problems we're going to face in terms of evolving is that that we're changing the amount of water and the kind of water around us faster than evolution actually takes place. So evolution takes place over many millennia, and we're changing the amount and quality of water that's available to us at in the years and tens of years.
One of the real changes during the last few years has been the trend toward drinking bottled water, and not just here, but in Europe as well. Maybe the Europeans were doing it first. I was shocked by many of the statistics involved with the cost and quantity of bottled water. Do you think this is a trend that has grown out of ignorance?
I think it's a trend that's grown out of concern for fresh, clean water. In the survey that we did of the United States, people said that 2/3 of the public was very interested in water conservation, and that same number of people were interested in the issue of water pollution and getting free and clean fresh water to their families. And so I think a number of people were thinking that bottled water was a solution to that problem.
There are, when I was a kid, mothers would say to their children, there are children starving in India, so eat your food. Can we say the same thing about there are children who are thirsty in various parts of the world, so drink your 8 glasses of water a day?
Well, I think what we can say is there are people who have, there are more than a billion people in the world who do not have access to fresh water in their lives, and so appreciate the amazing water that comes to us through the tap in New York City. And use the water that's available to us here rather than worrying about having bottled water in some other country coming to us, for instance.
Well, much of the world's population actually has to carry water every day because they just can't. It's not available to them locally.
That's very true. And some people can spend hours carrying extremely heavy water. And, in fact, we have a water bottle that you can pick up at the museum that's it's very heavy. A quarter of the water that women have to carry to bring water to their families during a single day.
How much of our water use is attributable to industry and agriculture?
You know, I think that's another statistic that surprised so many people, that 70% of the water that humans use in the world goes to agriculture. Another 22% goes to industrial uses, and then 8% is municipal or domestic use.
Well, the agriculture is still another way of sustaining life, but are there things we can do to cut down on the other uses of water?
Yes, in fact, about 30 to 50% of the water that we take, that we bring to agriculture, is in fact water that is lost through leaks. And so we can be more efficient about our water use in many different aspects of our lives.
Well, we in the West, we are seeing the sources of water quickly drain because that's where we get most of our agriculture. So will we be creating a situation, a dust bowl somewhere in the middle of California within the next century?
We could very well do that. And in fact, 25% of the foodstuffs in the United States comes from the Central California Valley, which is a very dry area. And they could have a lot less water than they expect if the snowpack that feeds that from the Sierra Nevadas declines.
Is desalinization a practical approach?
Many people ask whether desalination is a useful, since 97% of the Earth's water is salty. Could we convert some of that to fresh water for our uses? And it is certainly technically feasible, and we feature that in the exhibit, the technology that goes into cleaning salt out of salty water. The problems that we're facing at the moment with that technology is that you have two major problems. One of them is the energy that it takes to do that, the cost that it takes to do that. And in Perth, Australia, they've actually used wind energy to try to bring down some of those costs. But one of the other major problems is actually just extracting the water from an ocean environment. And then what do you do with this very salty brine that you have afterwards, the very salty water? It can impact some of the systems if you just dump that water back into the ocean system. So we have to think about
because we would be creating saltier oceans.
We would actually significantly increase the amount of salt in those immediate areas in the oceans.
Today there was an article in the Times about the effect of the Three Gorges Dam project in China, and it's mostly negative. People have been building dams since 256 BC, you point out.
That's right. We have
And beavers a lot longer
at a smaller scale, and a lot of these are issues of scale. And this, we do feature a dam in the exhibit that was built in China many thousands of years ago, and it's still functioning. It's an amazing feature of the environment, and it's still bringing it's still serving the local community in the way that it was originally designed to do. We started to build dams at bigger and greater scales and having larger impact both downstream and upstream. And I think we need to think carefully about how we could build dams better that mimic natural flows and have lower impact upstream.
The exhibit called Water, H2O Equals Life, will be at the American Museum of Natural History through May 26, 2008, so you still have time to go see it, although you may want to go back more than once because there's so much in it. My great thanks to Dr. Eleanor Sterling, Director of the Center for Biodiversity and Conservation, for being my guest.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.